Turn to the wonderful book of Isaiah, chapter 41 today. Chapter 41, we are thinking about this. We just finished a few messages out of chapter 40, and what a chapter that has been to study of hope and encouragement. And now we come to chapter 41, and maybe it feels like a little letdown here. You don't even know, unless you've looked at chapter 41, what it has. You don't know any verses out of chapter 41, right? So we're coming to chapter 41 today with a chapter that's not as known to us like chapter 40 is. But let me tell you, there's some truth here for us today. And so let us look at it as we come into God's word here today. There are times of life that we may doubt God. We may doubt what is he doing, his plan, right? I think certainly we can say Israel and Judah, there were times in their history where they doubted God. I think that's an accurate statement. I think this is one of them. I think hearing that they'd have to go into captivity was something that, you know, that was going to put some doubt about where's God. And especially after hearing these promises that we looked at in chapter 40. Now, one thing about God's people to doubt God, that's a problem. Because they had the law and they had the prophets, they had his word. Well, nations doubt. They don't even believe in God. The nations of those days did not have the law that had been given to them. So when you think about these nations like Assyria and Egypt and Babylon, they thought they were in power, right? They thought they were the ones that were in control of things. And humanly speaking, they were. And the people of those nations trusted in false gods. They trusted in those idols that we've talked about, right? And that we'll talk about again in this chapter a little bit and coming up in other chapters. So we have this, we have people who are doubting God. God, they're supposed to be God-fearing people that are doubting God. That's what we got going here. We got nations who think they're in control, and we got a host of people in both the nations and in Judah who are worshiping false gods. And they thought these idols were going to be very successful in defending their interests, and they thought they were worthy of worship. You know, that was the first hymn we sang today, worthy of worship. Of course, we're talking about Jehovah, but these people were thinking, oh yes, this idol on my mantle is worthy of worship, to bow down and to devote our time, because they believe that that idol has their best interest in mind and is powerful enough to do something about their problems and to save them and to deliver them. I want to tell you today, Isaiah is going to say in this chapter, firmly, God is in control. And that's the title of the message, In Control. Isaiah is going to demonstrate the great contrast between Jehovah and the idols. Between chapters 41 and 48, Isaiah will introduce three individuals that have not really been talked about, at least from this perspective, up to this point in the book. He is going to introduce with the names of either servant or shepherd. He is going to introduce these entities. First one is Cyrus, King Cyrus. We're going to learn a little bit about him today and more later. He is called a shepherd in Isaiah 44:28. He is going to call the unbelieving nation of Israel his servant in this chapter today. And he is going to, of course, call the perfect yet suffering servant, right? The Lord Jesus Christ in Isaiah 42:1 and 52:13. So Isaiah is going to, as he shifts this second half of the book from chapter 40 into the rest of the book, he is going to shift the focus from judgment to promise. The word servant in the Hebrew means a person working in the service of another. Another definition of it is to carry out the master's will, to do work, to do his work, to, listen, represent his interests. The servant that is used here in the book of Isaiah is not necessarily a derogatory term. You know, and you know, when we think of servant, we think of slavery, right? We think of slaves. And it does have that some connotation of a master and a relationship between doing what, but it isn't really a derogatory term. It is a person who has been given a solemn responsibility. A solemn responsibility. We're going to find part of that today. And of course, everything pointing to the Lord Jesus Christ, the great servant. What's the truth today? What unfolds in these coming chapters and starting today is going to prove without a shadow of a doubt that it is God and not man, it is Jehovah and not idols who will cause his servant Israel to be brought into captivity and then returned. It will be the Lord who will raise up Cyrus 100 years later from this prophecy to do what God wanted him to do. It will be the Lord who a few hundred years from Cyrus, who will raise up his messianic servant, his son, to come to this earth to do what he wanted him to do. All of these examples that come in the next few chapters are going to prove that Jehovah is God. He is exclusive deity, and he alone, specifically, is the only one who can truly, fully, perfectly foretell the future. In this chapter today, God is going to challenge the nations to a contest. He is going to challenge the idols of those nations in a part of this courtroom scene, as you'll see in just a moment, to see who is in control. And God, today, we're going to see, states his case. And he's going to give the idols a chance. But strangely enough, they don't have anything to say. Having proved his eternal deity, remember chapter 40? We just looked at God is great. God is sovereign. God is wise. He's proven he is deity. He is eternal. God is now going to assert to his people his right to their faith and trust. Did you hear that? In other words, if we believe in God and for who he is, and even if we don't, he still has the right to assert this, but God has all the right in the world to assert that we should trust him and live by faith. So the question is, do you? Do we? Did Judah? 2 points today in proving that God is in control. First of all, in verses 1 through 7, we're going to see that God is in control of Cyrus and the nations. And he will demonstrate through Isaiah's pen the foolishness to think anything else. Let's look here beginning in verse 41. God opens, well, Isaiah writing, but God says, "Keep silence before me, O islands. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Let them speak. Let us come near together to judgment." Isaiah 40, that's the last chapter, opened by addressing, remember, comfort ye my people. Isaiah addressed, or God was addressing Israel, but not in chapter 41 to begin with. Notice who he's addressing, the islands, the people, but not his people. This, in chapter 41, God is speaking to the heathen nations that surround his people. They are in the coastlands. They are in the islands of the Mediterranean Sea. These are the heathen. And what does God tell the heathen to do? He tells them something. He says, be quiet. He says, keep silence before me, O islands, O nations of that Mediterranean Sea that are kind of close to Israel in that day. You are to be silent. But why? Why does God tell the heathen nations to be silent? Because he wants them to focus on this. He wants them to focus on who their object of their trust is. Now, friends, who is the object of these nations' trust? You already know the answer. It's their idols. He wants them to take a look at who are they trusting. And he's going to challenge them on that basis. And he wants to challenge them to a contest. How do I know that? Look at the last phrase. He says, come together, come near, and he even gives them a chance to speak. I'm going to let you speak. I'm going to let you nation say something. I'm going to give you your chance, but I'm going to speak first. He said, let us come near together. Now, in our King James, it says to judgment, but this is a courtroom word, to justice. Come to the courtroom. Come to the place of judgment. Where was judgment? Where was the justice held? It's in a courtroom setting. It's a legal proceeding. God says, let's have a little judicial contest. Let's see who's in control. And I want you to just let me know or tell me who you're trusting in. And I'm going to give you my side and let's see who wins. That's all that's here. Let's see who's going to win. God is going to now tell the people, as the sole authority, by the way, can he command the heathen to come near to him and to do what he wants them to do? Yes. This will not be an even contest. I'll just tell you that to start with. God gives them a chance to state their case. And in the end, the purpose of this contest or this meeting is to pass a sentence to decide the case. And I'm going to tell you the case decision before we start today. God will be vindicated. His claims will be proven true, and it will be followed by a sentence that is passed down on the heathen nation and their gods, the nations and their gods. Verse 2. God says, I'm going to begin by asking you serious questions. Nations, here's a couple questions for you. Who raised up a righteous man from the east, called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings, gave them as dust to his sword and as driven stubble to his bow? Who did that is the first question. Who raised a man from the east? And I know what you're going to ask me. Who's the man from the east? But God isn't saying specifically, he isn't revealing who the man from the east is, because he wants you to, the emphasis is on who's raising the man up. That makes sense? Now, I'm going to tell you who I think the man is, but the emphasis is who is behind what this man is able to do. Now, it says righteous man. I'm going to tell you right off, and it's in your notes, that I believe this is Cyrus, the king who would be of the Medo-Persian Empire, who would defeat the Babylonians, who were holding captive the people of Judah. Now, this hasn't happened yet. This is 100 to 150 years before Cyrus is even around, which causes some problems for liberals. Because they're like, how in the world could God, how in the world could Bible specifically name someone who hadn't been born? What a small view of God. And we'll address that in a future sermon. But this person's a righteous man. That's what the Bible says. Who raised up this righteous man? Friends, if you know anything about Cyrus, you're not going to consider him a righteous man. So that's a problem. But the word righteous here is probably referring to somebody who is called according, listen, to the righteous standard and to do a specific task of God himself. In other words, listen to me, hear me out, is God righteous? And everything that he does is righteous and right? And if God calls even an unbelieving person to do his work, friends, is that going to be a righteous task? Absolutely. So he's calling a person to do his work. And again, I don't think the emphasis is necessarily on the person as much as God is able to do this long before it ever happens. And by the way, it happened. It happened exactly how God said it would happen. But he's calling somebody to do a righteous deed of God. If God calls even an unbelieving nation to do his work, it's an aspect of his will. And it's his right as much as anything else God does. Notice that he calls this man, he raises up this righteous man from the east, and he calls him to his foot. You say, well, oh, that is an interesting an interesting phrase. It's one of the more interesting phrases in the book of Isaiah, to be honest, because it just doesn't, you know, what is called, that's not language we use here today. But this is the idea. A foot is indicative of walking a path, right? You know, foot, you put one foot forward. Some of us, it's harder than others each and every day to do that. As we get a little older, we can hardly move those feet. But the picture is of walking that path, doing a task. Most of the tasks we do, we have to put our foot and move them and walk, right? This is the picture of somebody who is doing the service of another. So God has called a righteous person to do his righteous actions to serve his purposes. He called them to his foot. Called them to do the service task of God, which are righteous. And let me tell you that only success and victory awaits for this person. If God is behind him, that's all the option he has. And that's what he says. You can read it. He's called him, and what is he going to do? He's going to give all the nations that he encounters to him immediately. He is going to make him, this man, rule over every king that he encounters. He is going to turn him and kill him by the sword, and it's going to be easy. He's going to drive him with his bow, and he's going to make him stubble. I mean, dust by his sword, stubble. This man is going to be called to do God's bidding, and every nation will be given to him. He is going to trample over kings. He is going to make his enemies rulers as dust with a sword and pursue him as a wind-blown straw with his bow. You get the picture. This man, to be honest, is going to have no opposition. He's going to have an easy time of it. He's going to overrun his enemies. And God speaks in language as if it were already accomplished. In the Hebrew, the tenses are pictured here as if it's already done. And it hadn't even happened yet. It's amazing. Well, we already answered the question, who is this person? Most people think it's King Cyrus. I would agree, of Persia. He is not named until chapter 44, verse 28, and again in 45:1, but he fits the context of coming from the east. I'm just going to leave it at that. Let's see what else he does. Verse 3, he's going to pursue them. That's the nations. He's going to pass over the nations safely, even by the way that he had not gone with his feet. Cyrus is going to pursue his enemies, and he's going to pass by unharmed. He will advance by paths that he had never been on before, and on top of that, he will never have to go back and double over a path that he took. In other words, if he conquered one area, they wouldn't retake it, and he'd have to reconquer it. He'd conquer it, and that was it. And with God assisting, the servant Cyrus will have his victories assured. Nothing will stop this man. Nothing will stop his conquest. It'll be speedy. It'll be easy. There'll be no need to return to any battlefield to completely destroy any of his enemies. Why? Because God is behind us. But there's more. Verse 4, God asks another question in this courtroom scene. He is stating his case. The first question is, who's going to raise up Cyrus? And rhetorically, the answer is, I am. Question number 2, who hath wrought and done this? Who hath called generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, the first and with the last, I am he. In other words, God says, who not only called this one, who raised it, but who did this and accomplished these things? Who is behind all this? And the Lord answers his own question. On the basis of who he is, Jehovah declares unequivocally that this is the Lord's doing. God is the one who's going to bring these events to pass. God is the one who determines the destinies of generations. He is with and calls in the first generation, and he will do the same with the last one and everyone in between. Why? Because he's eternal. Who was around in the first generation of mankind? God. Who was in the last generation at this time? God. Nobody else can make that claim. And I can tell you, not one heathen nation could. Not one heathen idol could. But God, who is eternal, God, who is the first, God, who is the last, God, who calls every single generation from beginning of Adam to the generation of Isaiah's day, it was God was there. Who's accomplishing these things? God. I am He. Jehovah is the self-existent one. He existed before all else. He has no beginning or ending. Here we truly have the definition of Jehovah Yahweh, the I am that I am. And you can look at Exodus 3, one of my favorite passages in all the Bible, and learn about that name when Moses wondered if he was capable of leading these stiff-necked Jews out of Egypt. And God responded when Moses said, well, what name am I going to bring to these people? Who's sending me? God said, tell them I am the I am. Tell them the self-existent one, the one that's always been, the one that always will be, the one who makes covenants and always keeps them. That's what's being said here. That's what God says as He challenges the nations. Who's been here all this time? Man cannot escape God and His accomplishments. By the way, you can't either. But these people sure couldn't, and we can't. No nation has any ultimate control over their existence or future. This doesn't absolve nations and people of choosing righteousness or unrighteous deeds. In other words, listen to me, this doesn't mean that God is sitting up in heaven with a remote control and He's just running everything and we're all robots under God's commands. It doesn't absolve us of will to do actions. In other words, nations choose right and wrong. So do we. But behind that scene, and we get into difficult subjects here, right? Behind this scene, God is sovereignly working His will. And He is the one that is behind Cyrus. That doesn't mean that Cyrus didn't get to choose, should I follow God or should I follow false idols? And we're going to show you that Cyrus probably wasn't even an unbeliever. Historically, it is said that Cyrus followed Babylonian gods and false gods. That's who he followed. But yet he will admit that God was behind his success. So you can try to figure out, was he a believer or an unbeliever? I guess we'll leave that one to God. But my point being is, every person has a choice. Every ruler has a choice. Are they going to follow God? Are they going to believe and trust Him by faith? But behind the destinies, behind the nations, behind the people is God. God alone can call forth generations. And He has the choice to call forth people like Cyrus to accomplish His purposes and plans for righteousness. Look at verse 5. What was the response by the people? The islands saw it and they feared. The ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Here comes Cyrus. Now remember, this hasn't happened yet when it was written in Isaiah. But prophetically, it's as if it had happened. Here they come. Here comes the king. Here comes his armies. And all the islands, when they saw Cyrus, they were afraid. They were afraid. The ends of the earth were afraid. When he drew near and came, verse 6, they helped everyone his neighbor, and everyone said to his brother, be of good courage. So you know what they did? All the nations, when they saw Cyrus coming, each little kingdom, each little nation that by themselves would get overrun immediately, you know what they said? Let's make alliances. Brothers, let's get together. We can't stop this big machine by ourselves, so we need your help. And in fact, they said to him, make sure you're not fearful when he comes. Well, I can tell you right now, it didn't matter. All the alliances they put together would not stop God's man, Cyrus, from accomplishing God's task. It was all for a moot point. Well, what else did the people do? You know what they did? They turned to their idols. They banded together, they made alliances, and I believe it's as if Isaiah is mocking the nations at this point, because the nations knew that they would only offer very little resistance, in fact it was no resistance, against the God-ordained Cyrus-led invasion against them. But instead of making defensive preparations, like a lot of militaries you would think do, you know what they did? Let's go make idols. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith And he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering, and he fastened it with nails, that it should not be moved. The nations resorted to ever-increasing idol-making. Now remember, these nations would have already had a few million idols around their houses. I guess it wasn't enough. So they said, you know what? If we're going to keep Cyrus from defeating us, we got to make another million. And we're going to get them set up fast. Because that's the only thing that's going to save us. That was their thinking. Isaiah already had mocked idols in the prior chapter. Now he mocked the nations who thought their idols would stop God's promises, who would stop the righteous man from the east. The nations then chose their place, their hope. And we got to understand, these nations, for the most part, didn't recognize God. They didn't know God. Now, that didn't absolve them from seeing that God had created and believing in a creator and trusting in a creator. But they didn't have the knowledge of the people of Israel and Judah. We've already stated that. But no matter what, that isn't going to change the fact that they took their hope and their trust and put it in each other and in their idols, in their alliances and their idol making. And soon they would find that their 2 million idols, and that's just a made up number, their 2 million idols would be run over like stubble from a bow. And it would be run over and pounded into the dust with a sword. The people encouraged each person involved in the idol-making process to quickly create more idols, but it all was for naught. Let me tell you today, in this courtroom scene, God is asking two questions, and he is proving, I am in control of Cyrus, I am in control of the nations. Number two today, the second section here, God is in control of working out his promises and proving his sovereignty over his people. Because strangely enough, starting in verse 8, you might think that this courtroom scene would go on about the heathen nations and about Cyrus for quite some chapters. And it will pick up at times again coming up. But God switches in the courtroom scene and he brings up his own people here. He says, I want to enter into the witness stand. I got something to enter into as testimony. And I want to enter in, look at verse 8, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I've chosen. But, and he turns to Israel. He says, you, Israel, you are my servant. Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Isaiah now gives an address of God to his people to not only enter it into the witness or into the testimony, but to encourage the people that are left that are about to go to captivity. And he wants them to remind them of their status and their position before him. Jehovah reminds his people then of the great honor to be chosen by him. Hear the word servant. Notice the word servant refers to the nation as a whole. Israel is a servant. It's the whole nation. He's not talking to one person. Obviously, Israel and Jacob, though, that person had passed away. Abraham, these people had passed away. The patriarchs had passed away. He's referring to Israel as a servant. And he's referring to all of the history that's gone on, starting with Abraham. And God is saying, in a contrast with the heathen nations who he just spoke about, who find their comfort in idols, listen, Israel should find their hope and comfort in her God. The one who chose her. The one who loves her. The one who is the recipient of his blessings. The one who has been called a servant. The one who is honored to do a specific task. Friends, turn to Exodus 19. Because what task was Israel called to? Well, if you go back to Mount Sinai and the giving of the law, we find in the book of Exodus the great task that the people were called to. And obviously, we could go back to the Abraham, and even the verse here talks about Abraham, God's friend. But I want you to know that in Exodus 19, after the leaving Egypt, after the Passover, all that had happened. It's in the kind of in the rearview mirror a few months earlier, weeks earlier. We have the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. And you know chapter 20 in the book of Exodus. It's got the Ten Commandments, right? The big portion of what we know of the law. It's kind of that main moral portion we pull out of all the other individual commandments and laws and dietary restrictions and clothing restrictions and how one could move and operate and all of those things. We get these Ten Commandments. That's the next chapter. But in chapter 19, Moses has gone up to see God and visit him in the mountain. And God calls him out of the mountain in verse 3. And he says to the house of Jacob, and he says to the house of the children of Israel, "You have seen what I did unto the Egyptians." Remember what he did to them? The plagues? The Red Sea crossing? And notice this phrase. Look at verse 4, chapter 19. "How I bear you on eagle's wings." We're going to come back to that because that word "bear" is going to show up later in the book of Isaiah. That's a very important word. And I think it refers back to this verse. So don't forget that. We'll come back to that later, not today. But he says, "I bear you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore..." If you, just one small thing here, I gotta say, God says, just you have to obey. Okay, I'm being a little facetious, but that was the stipulation. You have to obey. Meaning if you disobey, there's consequences. And in Isaiah, we're finding out what the consequences were. Captivity. Because they didn't obey. But God says, if you obey and keep my covenant, then you will be a peculiar treasure. Above all people, unto me, above all people, all the earth is mine. And you will be unto me a kingdom of priests. Friends, did he call any other nation like this? No other nation was called out like this. This nation was special. This nation was chosen. I don't understand all the way God works. I mean, I do well just to read a couple of verses each day and try to understand how God's working his plan and put it all together. But God chose Israel for his purposes, his reasons, his grace, his love. That's what he did. And he chose him to be a special, unique treasure, a kingdom of priests, and a holy, separated nation. And we know all about this because he just gives a whole bunch of laws to make it obvious that that nation was going to be different. You might say, well, why did they have to wear such and such? Why did they have to eat such and such? Why did they have to do such and such and Sabbaths and all these things? Because they were going to be different than every other nation. It was going to be obvious who was their leader, who was their God. It was Jehovah. Jehovah called them out. These weren't arbitrary. God wasn't trying to stick pins in them. Say, I'm going to give you all these 600 plus commandments because I just really despise you. No, God says he loves them, but I want to make you different. They didn't respond very well most of the time. And they had a lot of problems and a lot of unbelief. But God, that doesn't take away the fact that God called them. God put the special blessing upon them. And then the rest of this chapter is as the acceptance of this and all that went on. And chapter 20, of course, is, by the way, how does chapter 20 open? What are the first couple of commandments? How does God open up? No gods before me. No other gods. Worship me alone. Idols are not an option. Back to chapter 41. He says, "Thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I've chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend." God chose this nation to be set apart as his servant. Jehovah chose to make his covenant with Abraham and Jacob. Yet even though God's people at this point in their history in Isaiah had for the most part chosen to follow their own ways, Jehovah reminds them of Jacob and Abraham, his friend. He reminds them of his covenant promises. And even though in the Mosaic covenant they struggled, God still had the covenant promises to Abraham and to David. And even though they would go into captivity, and then they would subsequently return, and the people would receive the consequences of not obeying the Mosaic covenant, of not acting like God's servant. And they would not do very well at learning the instructions on how to be a true servant. God calls them a servant, but were they acting like it here in Isaiah? He had told them, here are the instructions on how to be a servant, but they didn't follow it. So they didn't do well. They weren't very obedient to God, but in the grace of God, listen to me, he would bring forth a better servant, would he not? And that's what this is all pointing to. So let me explain this. God is saying, you didn't follow me. You weren't really acting as my chosen. I chose you, but you're not acting like chosen. I called you to be separate and holy, but you didn't act holy. I called you to be royal, a priest. You didn't, your priests were, I mean, it was a mess. By the time Jesus came, it was a real mess. God says, I'm going to still keep my word. I'm going to still keep my covenant promises. So you know what I'm going to do? Listen, I'm going to raise up Cyrus to bring you out of captivity after you hopefully learned your lessons. I'm going to bring you back. Cyrus is going to bring you back to the land, your land, and as my servant. And out of that servant, out of that people group that came back, friends, came the third one, Jesus Christ. God has a plan. And the way God orchestrated it and the way God worked it out tells me he's in control. He's in control. He uses probably a wicked king to do his bidding, to bring an unbelieving nation back to the land so that Jesus could be born in Bethlehem. The servant who could fix it all. And he did. Let me ask you a question today. Do the idols have anything on God? 9. God tenderly and compassionately is reminding his people that even as they enter into captivity, he will not forget them. He will not forget his promises. Friends, it may feel like today God's forgotten you. As we look at our world, maybe you feel like you're in captivity. And there's a lot of Christians that definitely are in captivity. And they might think, where are you, God? Friends, just like Judah was about to go into Babylon for 70 years, it's going to feel like that and it has for many years for Christians who live in persecuted countries. Let me tell you today, just as God did not forget his word and he sent his promised son the first time, he's not going to forget his word for us. He's going to send his son again. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, thou art my servant. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. God had chosen Israel on the basis of his grace and love. Even though they would be exiled because of their rebellion and unbelief, God had, he says, not rejected them. What an amazing God. If that were you or me, you know, if you had a worker, somebody that wasn't very faithful to you, you'd get rid of them. In the big picture here, and by the way, in the specific general picture, obviously God weeded out people. Jews died into captivity, on the way to captivity, on the way back from captivity. All of that is true. They paid the penalty. They paid the price. But friends, in the big picture, God's keeping his word. And that's for us today. God hasn't rejected us. God hasn't rejected his people, he says. He hasn't cast them off. 10. And look what he says. Fear, do not fear. For I am with thee. Be not dismayed. For I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Now that's the verse you know in this chapter. Now if I quoted it and didn't tell you the reference, my dad might be the only one that would have known it was in this chapter. Maybe one other, maybe two. But here's a verse that we know well, that we usually kind of apply to our life in difficult situations. But this is the context. Now you know where it resides. And with all that was going on in Judah, with all, it would be easy to conclude, God doesn't care about us anymore. They were on their way into this horrible place. Fear was going to come upon them when Babylon came marching at the door and knocking down their temple and destroying their city. Fear. But you know what God calls a nation to do? And I think specifically the remnant, specifically those who were the few left that were truly believing in Jehovah, Yahweh God. He says, you don't have to fear. When it all looks bad, when all of the people that we know seem to be leaving the faith, friends. Some of you can relate. When it looks like we're not the last one left standing, I'm not saying that because that's not true. We've got to hear and around us. But there's so many that grew up in the church and have left and walked away from God. In Judah, there wasn't many left. Most of them who had forefathers that had grown up and followed Yahweh were worshiping all idols. You know what God says to the believers? Don't fear. Don't fear. Don't be afraid. You don't need to fear Cyrus because he's going to be used by God. You don't need to fear the Babylonians because Cyrus is going to overcome them. Above all the earthly powers stands God himself. You do not need to fear. I will not cast this nation away. And to the believing remnant, that would have been an encouragement. Here we have an incomparable and immeasurable presence. God would be with his people. Therefore, what is there to fear? God's saying, don't fear the plan I have for you. Don't fear that I can't fulfill my promises toward you. Friends, what about you today? This isn't specifically for us. Isaiah 41 is not written to us. But this verse is easily applied to us. Because maybe you fear the plan that's being worked out in the world right now. Or it seems like the plan that's being worked out. What about, do we wonder, can God really fulfill his word? The word is, God will. He will. What else? God's presence here gives those who trust him solace of living without fear. God's presence strips us of any need to be afraid. God's strength guides and keeps the man or woman who willingly lays themselves at his mercy. He says, I will strengthen you. I will help you. And this is the place of true peace, even in life's storms. And Judah was facing storms, friends. The remnant was facing storms. Let's put it that way. God's upholding hand will make certain that his promises will never fail. This is a reassurance to the disheartened person. This is reassurance to know that the eternal God's presence, power, help, and support is there in all of life's situations. And listen, it may be bad and it may go bad, earthly speaking, for some of us. Or it has gone bad in, to some certain extent. God's going to still work his plan. People still had to go into captivity. But God says in the courtroom, I'm going to raise up Cyrus. How would God prove that it's unnecessary to fear? That's the rest of the chapter, or the rest of this section today. I'm going to go through this quickly. Verse 11 through 16, here is how God proves there's no reason to fear what's going to happen. Behold, all they that are incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. They will be as nothing. They that strive or attack you will ultimately perish. First, God is going to confound the enemies. He's going to make them nothing and he's going to destroy them. Number two, verse 12, thou shalt seek them and will not find them. Even them that contend with thee, they that war against thee shall be as nothing and as a thing of naught. God is eventually going to reduce Israel's enemies to nothing. That's his promise. That's why you don't have to fear, God says. Next, verse 13, for I, the Lord God, will hold your right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. God is promising he will walk with those who believe and follow him. And he holds them with his right hand. Or he holds their right hand, but that's obviously a picture of his right hand in theirs. There might be a sermon idea. You think about that. God is going to hold the hand of those who are trusting in him. And he says, I'm going to help you. Fear not. Idols aren't going to help. Idols ain't going to help do any. And obviously figurative here either way. Idols couldn't do it because they don't have hands. And God doesn't have a literal hand. But idols are so pointless and worthless. And we'll see that in the next chapter. They aren't going to do any good anyway. But God will. Next, verse 14. Now here's a strange one. He calls them not to fear because he calls them a worm. And you'll notice in my notes, verse 14, the reason that it's unnecessary to fear is because he calls them a worm. And then I said, why? Fear not, you worm Jacob. I'm just reading the text. And you men of Israel, hey, how about you men want to be called worms? That's what he called Israel. You men of Israel, you're worms. I will help you, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Well, what's a worm? A worm is one of the most insignificant things ever conceived by God. Job calls a worm, or says basically a worm, is something very insignificant and worthless. But that's probably not exactly, it's kind of a picture of what God is saying. This is describing the present condition of the nation. Let me tell you, they weren't supposed to be worms in the world. They weren't supposed to be like just on the ground being trampled upon. They weren't supposed to be insignificant. God called them to a specific task. In fact, it describes their very condition that they would go into Babylon. You think worms have a lot of ability to do, you know? Yeah, they burrow into the ground. I got that. Yeah, they can help your garden. I got that. But you put a worm against the lion, I'm thinking you're taking the lion every time, if you're honest. How about a worm against any other creature? Maybe a mosquito, you'll take the worm. You get the point. I don't even think you would take a worm over a fly, but that's another thing for another story, never another day. Listen, he's describing God's people as feeble, despised, and when they went to Babylon, they would be run over by heathen nations and Assyria if you throw them in. Yet he still calls them what? Men. And God says, I'm going to still help you. God says, I'm going to be your Redeemer on the basis of who I am, the Holy One of Israel, even though they would be deeply humiliated. And friends, hooks and noses by the Assyrian army was very humiliating. God says, I will continue to seek you and to see you as separated people to a separated God. And through the Lord Jesus Christ, like a humbled worm, despised and rejected, Psalm 22, verse 6, he will rise and redeem his people. Lastly, verses 15 and 16, God says, you don't have to fear because I'm going to cause you to overcome your enemies. Behold, I will make you a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shall make the hills as chaff. Thou wilt fan them, and the wind will carry them away. The whirlwind shall scatter them, and thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. One day, God is going to cause his people to overcome every single enemy. And he is going to raise up a new sharp threshing instrument. Now, I just want you to think about this. Could you imagine a worm with teeth that could thresh a mountain? That's the comparison being given here. The contrast. The contrast is of this worm who's going to turn into someone who's going to defeat all the other nations. Now, we know who's behind all that, and that's Jesus Christ. We know in the future, Jesus Christ is going to, those people are going to believe him, and he is going to come down, and he is going to do justice on every single nation that has opposed his people. That's the picture here. A downtrodden worm will become a nation that will be led by Jesus Christ. Their Messiah will destroy the strong mountains and hills. And it's only because God is on their side. Now, as we close today, we would say God is on our side, right? Let me ask you a question. Because I just want to ask you, do you really believe in Jehovah? The other option here seems to be idols. And again, I'm telling you, the next chapters will make that readily apparent that idols become an important part of the book. And we haven't gotten to those chapters yet. And you're telling me, and I tell myself, I worship God. I don't have idols in my house. What's an idol? An idol is anything that we put in place of God. Or worse, elevate above God. So let me ask you again. What could be an idol? I'm not talking about the thing on your mantle. Again, we know that. Money. Media. The internet. Television. Sports. Your gold watch. Time. Wasted time, yes. Family. I mean, lots of things become idols quickly. And you know what? It's almost as if the unseen idols are more hideous than the seen ones. In other words, America deals with more idols than I think they did in their days. And they're worse because a lot of them are good. I mean, they're good things. But what? Let me put it this way. This is a real serious thought. What did you spend on this week that you spent more time on than the things of the Lord? Now, I got it. I understand. You had to sleep. Okay? By the way, sleep can become an idol, right? But there are certain things that quickly we spend a lot of time on. And I would say, did you take time with God on a certain day? Take a day. Monday. Wednesday. I'm in the same boat with you, friends. I'm not exempt from any of this. But if there are things in your life that you know right away, yeah, you know what? I will admit, I probably spent too much time this week and didn't open my Bible much, or I didn't spend time with God. I knew that Robin Fleming was in the hospital, but I didn't pray. I knew somebody asked me about this, but I didn't really spend much time. I knew so-and-so needed something, but I found myself too busy to do my own. And it's not that we should do. We have our own things to do. I'm not saying that. But serving others is serving the Lord. But you know what we like to do? Serve ourselves. It's easy. It feels good. I'll tell you where joy resides. It's in worshiping and not in the idols. It's in following God. I think you understand what I'm saying today. Isaiah makes it clear that Jehovah's plan will be worked out to perfection, demonstrating he is in total control of his people. Whereas his people had failed them, he would not fail them. Whereas his people had trusted in false idols, he was proving he was in control and not the idols. Oh, friend, we need to come to the place today of trusting in Jehovah and not our idols. Let's pray.